is possible, even for those who consider themselves to be unfortunate. Perhaps publishing on this date was an oversight, but whether intended or not, it had the effect of injuring Franny more fully than she already was. Vincent tried to hide it. He threw the Times in the trash, but Franny found it when she took the garbage out to the bin. It was opened to the engagement announcements, and there it was in her hands, an arrow to wound her. Halen Walker, son of Ethan and Lila Walker of New York and Palm Beach, is engaged to Emily Flood, daughter of Melville and Margot Flood of Hartford, Connecticut. The groom is a graduate of Harvard College and Yale Medical School. The bride, a graduate of Miss Porter's school and Radcliffe College, is currently working at Talbot's in Farmington, Connecticut. Franny couldn't read on. Not about how the groom's father was the president of a bank and how his wife was on the board of the opera. Not about how the bride-to-be's parents were both doctors who raised boxer dogs that showed at the Westminster Kennel Club. Dating someone else was one thing, but this was marriage. This was the end of hope that it might ever be different between them. Franny burned the newspaper in the fireplace. The smoke was gray and gave off the bitter scent of sulfur. Afterward, she propped open the windows, and yet her eyes continued to tear. When Vincent came into the room, there was still a gritty mist hanging in the air.
"Hay's engaged,"
Franny told her brother.
"You shouldn't have tried to hide it from me."
"You should ignore it, Franny. How many years did you think he would wait for you? 10? 20?
"Shouldn't he have waited?"
"Not when you told him to go away. People believe you when you say things like that." "You never told him you loved him, did you?" Vincent held up his hands.
"Do as you please."
After he went upstairs, she did exactly that. She phoned Halen's parents' number, which she had memorized when she was 10 years old. When a housekeeper she didn't recognize picked up, Franny said she was calling about the engagement party. The housekeeper assumed she was a guest invited to the celebration that evening.
"Yes, yes," Franny said. "What was the time?" She had forgotten.
She wore her funeral dress, for her other clothes were all too casual. She slipped on a pair of her mother's old stiletto heels bought in Paris. They were red, which made Franny feel her kinship with her mother anew. The sky was a mottled pink and gray when she took a cab to park in 74th Street. Her chest hurt when the cab pulled up at the Walker's address. Their apartment took up an entire floor. Tonight it glowed like a firefly. Franny went inside the building, following an older couple and taking the elevator with them so she might be considered a member of their party.
"Such an exciting occasion," the woman said to Franny.
"Yes,"
Franny murmured in response. She had worn her brilliant hair twisted up so as not to call attention to herself, but she noticed the man staring at her shoes, her mother's red high heels. She kept her eyes downcast.
"And to think Ethan always feared his son would be a failure," the woman went on.
She was older but wore a Mary Quant miniskirt, along with a silk blouse and a long rope of pearls. The elevator opened directly into the apartment, and when it did, Franny felt as though she were dropping back through time. The party was crowded with guests, but otherwise it seemed exactly as it had when they were in grade school and Halen had first brought her home, only after she had made a solemn promise not to tell anyone how he lived. It was after they had met in the lunchroom, when she had given him half of her tomato sandwich, and he had eaten it without complaint, though it lacked salt and mayonnaise. The decor hadn't changed since that time. The same pale, pearly wool carpets, silk wall coverings, persimmon-colored sofas. Someone offered to take her coat.
"Oh, no, thank you," Franny said. "I'm cold."
Indeed, she was shivering. She was out of place with or without her coat. Nothing she had on seemed appropriate for this gathering. The women were in jewel-toned cocktail dresses, the men in well-tailored suits. Franny stayed on the edge of the huge formal parlor, where glasses of champagne were offered and hors d'oeuvres were served on polished trays. She thought she spied Emily through the crush,
but there were so many tall, pretty young blonde women she couldn't be sure. There was a table littered with silver gifts, platters, serving trays, candlesticks. Due to Franny's presence, many of the smaller silver pieces tarnished and turned black. She walked away from the table, embarrassed by what witchery could do. She avoided the other guests, but she couldn't hide from Halen, who came up behind her and put a hand on the small of her back. She felt the heat of his touch through her coat. She tried to catch her breath. "I couldn't send you an invitation," he said. "You never told me where you lived." He was in an expensive suit, his hair cut short. She didn't think she'd ever seen him in a suit before. But it was still him, her dearest friend, no matter what he wore, no matter whom he had promised to marry. There were spots of color on Franny's cheeks, and her hair had begun to unwind. She wanted to say, "Run away with me. Now I know nothing else matters. I don't care if we come to ruin." In her black coat with her shining red hair, she was impossible to miss. From across the room, Halen's father spied her. He glared and gestured for his son to get rid of her. "Let's step outside." Halen led her to the elevator. He pushed the button for lobby, but halfway down he stopped the elevator's descent and drew Franny to him. In an unexpected show of intimacy, he put his mouth against hers. It was so fast and intense, nothing could stop what happened next. It didn't matter where they were. It didn't even take courage to do this. It was fate, and they didn't try to fight against it. Franny threw herself at him, and Halen didn't stop her or himself. Although by now, Emily Flood was wondering where he'd gone, worrying because she'd seen a tall, pale woman with red hair. She still had nightmares about Franny, for after Franny's visit to the hospital, it had taken Emily months to win back Halen's affections. "Don't you see?" she had told him. "She's never coming back to you. She doesn't care, or she would have come to Cambridge with you." What Emily Flood had feared had come to pass. It all happened too fast, and then they realized where they were and what they had done. Halen backed away, pulling up his pants like a fool, pained by his own actions. He was not a disloyal man, yet he had just betrayed his fiancée. "I'm getting married," he said, shaking his head as if puzzled by his own statement. "I know. I read about it in the New York Times." Franny tilted her chin up, ready to be hurt by whatever he would next say. She felt this was her last chance, and she was taking it. "I have to marry her," Hay told her. "Do you hear yourself? Have to?" Halen groaned and said, "You always do this to me. You make me think I have a chance." The elevator alarm went off. Halen did his best to stop it, but in the end he had to punch the up button for the sirens to subside. The elevator resumed, climbing back to the 17th floor. When the doors opened, Ethan Walker was there. Both Halen and Franny blinked and looked guilty. "I thought I made myself clear," Halen's father said. "Get rid of her." Mr. Walker was utterly impossible to see into, closed as a locked vault. Franny, however, was completely transparent at this moment, a woman in love who had just been fucked in the elevator and clearly didn't give a damn about anyone else's feelings, certainly not those of the bride-to-be, who had gone off to lock herself in the bathroom to weep, terrified she had already lost Hay before he was hers. "Don't make an ass out of yourself," Walker said to his son. "She dumped you, and she'll do it again. Do the right thing for once in your life." Franny saw the expression set on Hay's face. When his father left them, she tugged on Hay's sleeve. "Don't listen to him. You never have before." Halen looked at Franny. "It's not about him, Franny. You know I don't care about my father's opinion." "But all those years, you should have contacted me." "I didn't want to ruin your life," Franny explained. Hay laughed bitterly. "But now you do?" Franny recoiled, stung. "Is that what I'm doing?" Hay appraised her coolly, and she could see how she'd hurt him. "I don't know, Franny. You tell me. Because I'm not sure I want my life ruined." He shook his head, his confusion evident. I keep thinking about when I was drowning and you didn't come in after me. And when we were going to school together and you didn't come with me. But you didn't drown. And you did fine without me at school. But you resent me for everything. I see I shouldn't have come. Franny hastened into the elevator, but Hay threw his arm across the door, making certain it wouldn't close. I couldn't go through losing you again, he said. It killed me. It took me years to get over you. But you did get over me. You found someone else. I didn't. Tell me you won't walk away again and I'll call the whole thing off. Franny took a step back, startled by his raw emotion. Tell me, he demanded. And I'll do anything. I'll hurt her if I have to. That was when Franny saw Emily. She had come to search for Hay and was watching them from the parlor. Franny lost her voice then and felt the courage drain from her body. Who did she think she was to cause another woman such grief? Perhaps Emily was Halen's fate, and Franny would only be interfering in what was meant to be. You still can't make a promise to me, Halen said. And in that moment, he let the elevator go. On the street, Franny hailed a cab. She rode along past the gates into the park she and Halen used to walk through. Love had to happen without any certainty, the ultimate leap of faith. But Halen now stood beside Emily Flood while Franny was headed downtown, weeping as she looked out at the world she had once known. Once a month, Jet went to Massachusetts. She told no one in her family, but they knew. Sometimes Franny packed her a lunch and left it on the kitchen table. A cucumber sandwich, some cookies, a green apple. Vincent often left out cash for the bus. She was grateful, but she never discussed her plans with them. She simply went early on the last Sunday morning of the month. When she got to town, she took the local taxi to the cemetery, and she always brought daffodils, no matter the season. She sometimes stopped at the local grocery that sold flowers. Everyone knew who she was, but treated her politely all the same. In the spring, she walked to the cemetery, and she picked her own flowers, the ones that grew in the fields that were the color of butter. Isabel did not consider it rude that Jet didn't stop in to see her, although once or twice she had spied her niece walking through town. One time in particular, she'd happened to be going to the library when she noticed Jet standing in front of the Willards' house. Maybe it was a good sign, or maybe it wasn't. Only time would tell. The Willard home was a white house with green shutters, more than 200 years old, with a huge garden that had never regained its former glory once the Reverend had cast down salt on the day when April Owens blundered in, aiming to pick some of his pie-plate-sized roses. Now the rose bushes were bare and the leaves curled up. The only things that grew here were daffodils, and Jet was surprised to see that there were hundreds of them. There was an apple tree that Levi had told her about. He'd said he loved to climb the tree and pick crisp Macintosh apples, but now the bark of the tree was leathery and black, the boughs were twisted and bare. It hadn't borne fruit for years. Jet was leaning on the white fence looking up at the second-floor window where Levi's room had been when the Reverend came out. He was putting out the trash, but he saw her and stopped. They looked at each other in the fading light. "I'd like to see his room," Jet said. The Reverend no longer attended to any services. He didn't attend to anything. He no longer watered or weeded his garden. The gutters on the house were sagging, and the roof needed work. There were two rocking chairs on the porch he never sat in. He didn't want neighbors passing by to greet him or wish him well or ask him how he was faring. He looked at the Owens girl with the dark hair and her serious pale face with the scar on her cheek, and then he signaled to her. He didn't know what he was thinking or if he was thinking at all, but he watched her come into the yard and up the porch steps. "I appreciate it," she said. "Thank you." She followed the Reverend into the house and up the stairs. The carpeting was beige and the walls were white, but yellowing. There was the scent of mothballs and of coffee that had recently been brewed. No lights were turned on. The Reverend didn't like to spend the money on electricity bills. Plus, he could see just fine until it was pitch dark. After dark, he went to bed. Or he sat by his window, looking into the yard as if he could see back through time into the past. His wife had died much too young, of cancer, and maybe that was when everything started to go wrong. He was strict with his son, and he feared bad luck, and then it seemed he had brought it upon himself and upon everyone near him. "Watch your step," he found himself saying, for the stairs were steep. Once inside, the Reverend switched on a lamp. Jet had wanted to see Levi's room ever since they'd met. Whenever they sat in the park, he would describe it in the greatest of detail. The blue bedspread, the trophies he'd won on the swim team, photographs of his mother and father on a picnic out by the lake. The wallpaper was blue and white stripes, the rug was tweed. Jet stood in the doorway now. If she closed her eyes, she could see him sitting on the bed, grinning at her, a book of poems in hand. Her eyes were brimming and hot. "Unable are the loved to die, for love is immortality," Jet said, quoting Emily Dickinson. When she opened her eyes, the Reverend was standing beside her, crying. They stood together like that until the light changed, with bands of blue falling across the floor. After a time, Jet followed him downstairs. He opened the screen door for her, and they walked into the garden of daffodils. Everything else was black, even the soil.
"I can drive you to the bus station," the Reverend said.
"That's okay. I like to walk."
He nodded. He liked to walk, too.
"You can come by next time," he said. When she looked at him confused, he added, "I know you're here every month. I see you at the cemetery, but I don't want to disturb you. I know you want your time with him."
Jet stood on the sidewalk and watched him walk back up the steps to the porch. The lamp had been left on in Levi's room, and it cast a yellow glow. Jet waved and then turned. She walked the long way to the bus station. She liked to walk through town, especially in the fading light. It brought her comfort to know that for more than 300 years people in her family had been in this town, walking where she walked now. The next time she came, she wouldn't wear this black dress, which was too warm for the season. And she would come earlier in the day so she would have more time, because for the first time in a long time, she felt she had all the time in the world. On June 28, 1969, the weather was hot, 87 degrees, unusual for the time of year. New York City grew steamy, as if the heat rose from its core. On Christopher Street, between West 4th and Waverly Place, the Stonewall, a restaurant that had originally been a staple, was burning from the inside out. The heat was trapped, and it had to rise up. Organized crime ran it as a gay bar, and everything about it was illegal. There was no liquor license, and corrupt officials were handed enough cash to look the other way. Sometimes they did, but sometimes they chose not to, despite the payoffs. There were raids, and customers, including trans people, drag queens, and the young and the homeless, were beaten and humiliated and jailed, dragged onto the street, cuffed, bloodied, and facing a legal system that saw them as without rights. Late on this particular night, Vincent was walking with his dog when he came upon a crowd that was growing by the minute. He could have gone in another direction, but he came this way. Later he would wonder if he knew, if he needed to see for himself who he was and where he belonged. He usually paid no attention to anyone when he walked his dog at night, as he would have paid no mind to the crowd, which had been growing in number ever since the brutal arrests, had the police not encircled the area. 8 officers who had beaten customers were trapped inside, and when tactical forces arrived as backup, a riot began. Garbage cans and bricks were being used by the crowd to defend themselves. Vincent stood there, frozen. When confronted with the enormity of what was happening, the pure revolutionary action of standing up to be who you are, he was unable to move. "Be yourself," his aunt had told him. Was this who he was? A man who feared to show himself? A rabbit?
He could not have despised himself more at that instant.
"Why don't you do something?" someone shouted.
One of the homeless kids from Christopher Park was being beaten, doing his best to protect his face with his hands. Before he could think, Vincent pushed the officer off. He concentrated, and a hail of stones fell, scattering several of the officers. When the kid limped away, the officer went for Vincent, tackling him. Vincent toppled, his face hitting the cement. Harry was barking like mad and would have attacked whoever came after him next, but Vincent gathered his wits and rose to his feet, calling the dog off. They ran down West 4th Street, off the pavement, cutting off traffic. Vincent was bleeding, a gash down the left side of his skull. He let the dog into the yard at 44 Greenwich before going to the ER at St. Vincent's. For days afterward there were riots, and many of the wounded would be brought here. Vincent himself had a concussion and was in need of stitches, and there was the matter of his hand, which had bent backward during his fall. They sent an intern to take care of him. "What have you done to yourself?" the tall, rangy intern asked. When Vincent gazed up, he saw Halen Walker, in his scrubs, a look of worry on his face. "There's a riot out there, Dr. Walker. I didn't do this to myself." Halen then recognized him.
"You!"
He threw an arm around Vincent so heartily Vincent winced in pain. "Are you sure you're a doctor?" Vincent asked. Hay grinned. He still had the same easy smile he'd had at 15.
"Pretty sure. I just got posted to a residency at Beth Israel."
He was good at stitchery, and, because there were many other patients waiting for him on this day, extraordinarily fast. "There, your looks won't be ruined." "What a mess today has been." He got to work on a cast. "You may have trouble with this hand for a while." "I was lucky. It's mayhem out there." Hay looked embarrassed, but he swallowed his pride to ask, "How's Franny?" "Considering you let her go, do you care?" Hay gave Vincent a look, then took a moment to sit beside him on the gurney. "Does anything turn out the way we want it to?" Vincent got up, leaving Halen to the line of patients waiting for him. "You want to be smart?" Vincent said before he went to check out. "Don't waste time when there's someone you love." When Vincent came home, Franny made him lie in bed with an ice pack on his skull. "Wrong place, wrong time," Vincent explained. But the night had done something to him, and in fact he no longer felt as alone in this life. He was part of something bigger than himself. All the same, he wanted to protect William. "Do not call him," he told Franny. "He's out at Sag Harbor with his family. I don't want him to worry." But William had the sight and knew something was amiss. When he turned on the news, the riots were on every channel. He came the next morning, driving his father's old Jeep, parking illegally, pounding at the door. Franny let him in, and he paced in the parlor while she told him what had happened. He was already damning himself for not being a part of it. He went upstairs and knocked at Vincent's door. When there was no reply, he said, "I'm not taking no for an answer." Vincent came to the door, his appearance shocking. William embraced him, then stepped back to take a better look. "We're getting out of the city," he said. He found Vincent's suitcase and began packing. "Why go?" Vincent said. "We can't escape from who we are."
"Of course not.
Why would we want to do that?" Vincent laughed, for he agreed. "We wouldn't."
"I'm glad you feel that way, Vincent.
Because I certainly don't wish to be anyone other than who I am, and I don't wish to deny it. I'm taking you to see someone who had to do that all his life."
"Who's that?"
Vincent asked. William opened the bedroom door. It was time for them to leave.
"My father."
They went to the town of Sag Harbor, where William's family had a home dating back hundreds of years. The house had been a summer place, a ramshackle wood-shingled building with huge porches that overlooked the glassy sea and the shoreline of Shelter Island. But it had been insulated, and a heating system had been put in. Now William's father lived there year-round.
He was tall, and Vincent saw that William resembled him in many ways, not just in his appearance, but also in his calm demeanor, which belied a passionate heart. William used to row out to the island in storms just to see if he could. He went in a hurricane once, despite my warning. He wasn't one to ever back down. William's father had been waiting for them at the far end of a great green lawn. He embraced William and then embraced Vincent as well, extremely happy for their company. "My son has always been brave, and he reveals that to all who know him. I've always envied him this quality, for it escaped me completely." They cut across the lawn, then walked down a lane past a small cemetery, where the Grants had always been buried, the first being Everett Rejoice Grant, who had died in 1695. Family mattered to the Grants. William had been an only child, but that had been made up for by scores of cousins and friends. William's mother had an apartment in New York and stayed there year-round, but she came out to celebrate Thanksgiving with the family, despite having a separate life from her husband. It was a clear, bright, beautiful day, the air tinged with salt, the climbing roses blooming. The graveyard was filled with sunlight. Retired now, Alan Grant had been at the district attorney's office in Manhattan for nearly 30 years. All the while William was growing up, his father didn't come home until late, sometimes not until 9 or 10. And then he would sit up even later, files spread out over the dining room table. He got lost in his work and often forgot his family. Those days, however, were long gone. Today he had set out lunch for his guests on a porch that overlooked the sea. There were oysters and a salad and white wine. There were roses in a milky vase in the center of the table on a white lace cloth that had belonged to William's great-grandmother. "I hear you were there at the riots," Mr. Grant said. "My darling son has always thought he could win over everything nature set before him, and I admire his attitude. We must fight against bigotry in all its forms, for it is prejudice that ruins a society." "So says the DA," William said, clearly proud of his father. "I'm proud of you, too," Mr. Grant said, toasting Vincent. Vincent was abashed. "Me? I did nothing. I just stumbled into it and managed to get myself beat up." "It's more than that. I'm proud you can be honest about who you are." "Well, it's recent, believe me." "I have every cause to believe you, especially because you are with my son. He knows truth when he sees it." After lunch, Vincent and William walked down to the shoreline. The beach was rocky, covered with small mossy stones at low tide. Out in the water there was a blue heron that looked like Edgar, the stuffed bird in the shop. Herons mate for life, and Vincent thought this was a good sign, and an even better sign that Mr. Grant had seemed to like him. "My father felt he had to hide the fact that he was homosexual. My mother knew, of course, and they had their arrangement, but at work and in the larger world, he couldn't have anyone know. It would have likely meant his job and would have left him open to blackmail, which he paid off once or twice. It was not a way to live, and it took a toll. On all of us, but especially on him. We loved him, but he despised himself, so it made for rocky going sometimes." Vincent recounted the story his aunt had told about their cousin Maggie, who, having denied who she was turned into a rabbit. "That clearly didn't happen to your father."
"No.
In spite of all of us, he managed to have quite a life of his own. He's no rabbit. He's a fox." They both laughed. "Well, so are you," Vincent said. "He taught me what to be and what not to be, and I'm grateful that I live in this time, now, with you. It's far from perfect, but it's not what my father went through. He was the one that was usually out rowing, if you really want to know, not me, and sometimes I feared he wouldn't come back, that he'd just keep going until he reached a place where he could be happy, or happier. He took on the worst cases, murder, rape, because he wanted to change the world in his own way, but also because he needed to fight, and he couldn't fight for himself. That's one of the attributes that first attracted me to you. You're a fighter."
"Am I?" Vincent said.
You'll see, when the time comes. You'll fight for the life you want.
After walking for a while, they stopped by a tide pool and took off their shoes. And then, as if having the same thought at the same time, they undressed and raced into the water, whooping, for it was cold as ice. Vincent was alive, more alive than he'd ever imagined he'd be. He dove into the water and everything was green. His mind was clear and cold. His heart pounded in his chest. He was caught up in the water, but he knew he couldn't drown. All the same, William reached for him and steadied him, then pulled him out of the tide.
"You're mad," William said. "There's a current. It doesn't matter to us."
Vincent threw his arms around William.
He dared to think that at last he was truly happy. He looked out to Shelter Island. He had the urge to swim for it, to try something impossible, for everything he'd done up to this time seemed selfish and small.
"You matter more than anything to me," William said. Vincent shook his head.
"You think too highly of me."
"I know exactly who you are," William responded. "Just as I always knew who my father was. And I loved him, not despite it, but because of it. The way that I love you, because of who you are."
One still night, people happened upon a deer lying on the ground in Washington Square Park. No one knew where it had come from, although there were said to be deer in the Bronx, and perhaps this one had come down along the riverside. It was an albino deer, said to bring bad luck. It was curled up beside a wooden bench, and the next morning all the children in the neighborhood came to see it. There it still was, sleeping in the park. And even children who didn't believe in fairy tales found themselves believing. They stood on the concrete paths in awe of the woodland creature. It was so silent, and it didn't seem the least bit afraid. The children left hay and grass, and a few brought other offerings. Sugar, blankets, sweet herbs. For many, it was a time when miraculous things happened every day. This past summer, Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin had been the first people to reach the moon on Apollo 11, landing in the Sea of Tranquility. It seemed the distance between Earth and the stars and planets was growing smaller, and perhaps the world, that floating blue orb, could be better than it had ever been. But there was no peace to come. Instead, there was unrest in cities that were brutal and brutally hot. In the park, there were swarms of bees, so many that Franny took to wearing a scarf when she sat beneath the hangman's elm. She brought the deer a bowl of cool water, but it refused to drink. She could see in its eyes that it had given up. Sometime in the night, someone shot the deer with a bow and arrow, as if hunting season had been declared in Manhattan. People were outraged, and a sit-in began, with many of the protesters the same children who had tried their best to save the deer. The mayor took up the cause, and the collection was raised so the deer could be buried on the grounds of the cloisters. For days after the murder of the deer, there was a trail of blood on the concrete path where the poor creature had last lain. Near that place, the children of P.S. 41 planted a rose bush one murky afternoon. It bloomed overnight with masses of white flowers, though the blooms were out of season. It was a miracle, everyone said, and some were satisfied, but to anyone with the sight, there was still a sense of doom in the park. Franny stopped going to Washington Square. Instead, she sat shivering in their own small garden, and she waited for whatever was bound to happen when a white deer appears, when white roses bloom overnight, when bees follow you home to nest in your rooftop. It didn't happen until October. A letter arrived at 44 Greenwich on a Sunday afternoon, a time when mail wasn't delivered. There was no stamp and no return address, but the cream-colored stationery and the slanted handwriting were instantly recognizable. The missive was addressed only to Franny. "Aren't you the lucky one?" Vincent said dryly. He had stopped by for coffee, as he often did in the morning when William left to teach his classes. Franny looked at the envelope on the floor by the mail slot. She had no urge to retrieve it. In fact, she had gone quite cold with dread. In the end, Jet was the one to get the letter. She looked at her sister and Franny nodded.
You open it.
Wren hopped on Jet's lap as she sat down to inspect the envelope. When the cat batted a paw at the letter, there was the thrum of a bee.
Better take it outside, Jet suggested to Franny. It's addressed to you, after all.
Franny went out to the rickety back porch. The city smelled like possibility and corned beef hash. Franny used a dull knife to slit open the envelope, then watched as a bee rose into the cloudy air. The last time they'd seen bees, they had portended a death. The note inside was brief. Come today. Isabel did not often make requests, and when she did, it was best to comply. So Susanna Owens had believed, and so her daughter did as well. Franny packed a suitcase and took the bus to Massachusetts within the hour. Jet had packed her a lunch, a tomato sandwich and a green apple, and a thermos of travel well tea, composed of orange peel, black tea, mint, and rosemary. Riding through the lush New England countryside, Franny thought of the first summer they'd come to visit, when Halen wrote letters every day. She thought she could have what she wanted. She thought she could see the world from above, as if it were a distant blue ball whose sorrows had nothing to do with her. She had wanted to be a bird, but now she knew, as she looked out the window to see Lewis following, that even birds are chained to earth by their needs and desires. There was a chill in the air, and Franny wore her mother's ember spring coat and tall lace-up black boots, along with jeans and a shirt that had been Vincent's cast-off. She had an awful feeling in the pit of her stomach. A one-line message was never good. It meant there was no recourse to something that had gone wrong. For what you can fix, there are 100 remedies. For what cannot be cured, not even words will do. To Franny, it seemed that nothing had changed when she walked toward Magnolia Street, except that the Russells were no longer in residence. The house had been painted, and two unfamiliar girls played in the front yard. Franny stopped and leaned over the fence, curious.
"What happened to the family before you?" she asked.
"They were stinkers," one of the girls said.
"We had to burn sage in all the rooms," the older of the two sisters confided.
She was all of 10.
"Bad karma. We got the sage from the mean old lady at the end of the street."
Isabel.
"What made her mean?" Franny asked.
"She always wore black and a pair of old boots," the older sister said.
The girls suddenly stopped their play and looked at Franny more carefully. Her black coat, her boots, her blood-red hair piled atop her head.
"Oh,"
both sisters said thoughtfully. The girl's mother came to the door with a skeptical expression.
"Lunch,"
she called, clapping her hands. When the girls skittered into the house, their mother walked onto the porch, hands on her hips, eyes fixed on Franny.
"Is there something I can help you with?"
Franny detected a stain on the porch beneath the gray paint. Crimson. She felt her face grow flushed. She knew what it was, and it didn't bode well.
"What happened to Mrs. Russell?"
"Are you a relative?"
Sometimes the truth was the best way to find out more of the truth.
"I'm Franny Owens. I think you got some sage from my aunt."
The neighbor continued to be wary.
"What if I did?"
"If you did, I'm glad she could help you."
The woman relented and came a little closer. She no longer seemed quite as guarded, so Franny went on.
"Mrs. Russell was involved with my brother," she explained. "So I just wondered."
"Well, it's a good thing he wasn't around when it happened. Her husband? He was kind of a mild-mannered guy. He murdered her. I take it she had all kinds of improper flirtations. We got a great price on the house because of the crime, but I've had to go to your aunt half a dozen times to try to rid the place of her aura. It still smells of burning rubber in the basement."
"Try some lavender sachets. Put them in every room and bury one under this porch."
"Frankly, it's good you're here," the neighbor confided. "Your aunt hasn't had the porch light on for weeks. People in town are a bit worried about her, but we all know she values her privacy." Franny thanked the neighbor and walked on. October was such a tricky month. Today, for instance, it was as chilly as winter time, but the sun was bright. The weather report predicted that the following day would be in the 60s. Vines snaking around the old house were still green, but there were no leaves, only thorns. When Franny went through the gate, she noted the garden hadn't been put to bed as it usually was at this time of year. The beds had not been raked. Tender plants had not been taken into the greenhouse, where they would winter over in the faint sunshine. The new neighbor had been correct. The porch light, always turned on to let those in need of a remedy know they were welcome to call, burning for more than 300 years, was turned off. Moths caught inside the glass dome were fluttering about helplessly. Finding the door unlatched, Franny shoved it open. Colder inside than out. A sign of a passing over to come. Franny kept her coat on. Her throat tightened as she walked through the house, the echo of her heels clattering on the wooden floor. There were dishes in the sink, unwashed, and dust glazed the furniture. Isabel was always meticulous to a fault. Now there were ashes in the fireplace. Herbal encyclopedias were scattered over her bed. There was one book of poems, a present from Jet, one Yule. The Complete Poems of Emily Dickinson. Franny came to see that the back door had been left open. A beetle squatted on the threshold. Death Watch beetles are wood borers. They can be heard in the rafters calling for mates, and there was a call from somewhere inside the ceiling. There was nothing Franny could do about the beetle hiding in the attic, but she stepped on this one and crushed it flat, then went on to the garden. The lilacs were bare, but she swore she could smell their scent. "If there are lilacs," her aunt had told her once as they'd worked in the garden, "there will be luck." The spindly plant in the backyard of 44 Greenwich was one of the reasons she'd decided it was the right house for them. She went on to the greenhouse, thinking of the night she learned to make black soap, and in doing so learned who she was. The door was ajar, and she peered inside. There was Aunt Isabel sitting in a wicker chair. "You received my note," Isabel said when Franny came to her, her voice a dry rasp. Her skin was sallow, and she was clearly chilled to the bone, for she wore a sweater, a coat, and a shawl. Still, she trembled. "I won't play games with you. It's pancreatic cancer. One can't escape every evil under the sun." Franny sank onto the wicker ottoman and took her aunt's hands in her own. Her emotions swelled into panic. "Is there no cure?" "Not yet." Isabel was honest above all things, a trait Franny admired. It was an important rule. Nature could be shifted, but not controlled. "Not for me," Isabel said. "But, darling, you can cure yourself. I wanted to make certain I spoke to you about this matter right away." Franny smiled softly. It was so like her aunt to worry about her when she was the one who was dying. "I have no disease." "You will," Isabel said. "Unless you love someone." Franny bent to rest her head on her aunt's knees. "You know I can't. It's not possible in our family." "Maria Owens did what she did for a reason. She was young, and she thought damning anyone who loved us would protect us. But what she had with that terrible man wasn't love. She didn't understand that when you truly love someone and they love you in return, you ruin your lives together. That is not a curse, it's what life is, my girl. We all come to ruin. We turn to dust. But whom we love is the thing that lasts."
"Maybe I'm afraid of love," Franny admitted. "It's too powerful."
"You?" Isabel scoffed. "Who chose courage? You're stronger than you know, which is why I'm leaving you what matters most. The book." Franny raised her head, touched by her aunt's generosity. Her eyes were brimming with tears.
Can we change what's happening to you? You once said that just as anything whole can be broken, anything broken can be put back together again.
Isabel shook her head.
Everything except for this. Death is its own circle.
How long do you have?
She asked her aunt.
10 days.
Then and there they began the work that would take 10 days to complete. They shielded the furniture from daylight and dust by laying down white sheets. They made soap out in the garden, the best batch that had ever been prepared. If used once a week, it could take years off a person's appearance. They wrapped the portrait of Maria Owens in brown paper and string for storage, then put bay leaves and cloves in the closets to keep moths away. They telephoned Charlie Merrill, who could be trusted to keep their business private, and had him exterminate the attic and the rafters to rid the house of beetles. Before he left, they asked him to fashion a plain pine coffin, and to please do so quickly. He stood there blinking, choked up and not knowing quite what to say to Miss Owens.
"I can't do that," he said, distraught.
"Of course you can, and I'll appreciate it, just as I've appreciated all of your hard work over the years," Isabel told him.
She handed him a check for $10,000, since she had been underpaying him for 50 years, and when he protested, she simply wouldn't hear anything more.
"We have too much to do to argue," she said,
and off she and Franny went to the pharmacy, where they ordered hot fudge sundaes with marshmallow cream at the soda fountain.
"Much too fattening," Aunt Isabel said.
Her hand shook each time she lifted the spoon.
"But we don't care," Franny said,
though she had noticed that Isabel was only taking small bites, and that her silver sundae cup was overflowing with melted ice cream. They saw to all of their chores, readying the house and the garden, and on the 8th day, when Aunt Isabel could barely walk, they had Charlie take them to the law firm in Boston that the Owens family had always used. There, a will was taken from a file. It had been drawn up after Franny had come to spend the summer. Isabel now confided that she had known right then. Franny was the next in line. Once they'd been ushered into a private office, they sat in oxblood red leather chairs facing the lawyer, Jonas Hardy, a young man with sad, moody eyes. His father and grandfather and great-grandfather had all worked for the Owenses. He shyly addressed Franny.
"You are the trustee for your brother and sister when it comes to the house, in which you have equal shares. Everything else, however, goes directly to you. That includes all belongings, furniture, dishes, silver. There is a trust used to manage the house, so you never have to worry about taxes or upkeep. But you can never sell the house. You understand?"
"Of course she understands," Isabel said. "She's not a nincompoop."
Franny signed the necessary papers, then they had tea and sugar cookies.
"Your aunt gave me this tea when I first met her," Jonas Hardy said. "She sends a box here to the office every year."
He lifted his cup.
"Thank you, Miss Owens."
Franny took a sip. Courage. They all shook hands when the papers had been signed and the tea had been drained to the last drop, and then Franny and her aunt got into Charlie's waiting car, and they navigated the bumpy streets of Boston, which had been cow paths when Maria Owens first came to set up the initial trust for her daughter and her granddaughter and all the daughters to follow. Aunt Isabel rested her head back and dozed. She woke once when they hit a pothole and was clearly disoriented.
"Is this New York?"
"No, we're going home," Franny assured her.
When they arrived at Magnolia Street, Franny brought her aunt into the house and up to bed. She helped Isabel undress and gently pulled her nightgown over her head. Her aunt was still shivering, so Franny found some wool socks and a knitted shawl. She brought in a basin of warm water and used a soft washcloth to clean her aunt's face and hands with black soap. In the morning, she phoned Jet and Vincent and told them to come. They rented a car and arrived on the afternoon of the 9th day, having sped along the Mass Pike at 90 miles an hour, fearing that time was against them. They trooped into the house, and without bothering to remove their coats,
came to sit at the foot of Isabel's bed. They were all silent, too dazed for any emotion. All three had been half convinced Aunt Isabel would live forever. What was happening seemed impossible. Things ended, and then they began again, only they would begin without Isabel. A sparrow darted inside the house and flew around the room. Franny fetched a stepladder from the linen closet, climbed up, and held out her hand. "Don't come back here on Midsummer's Eve," she told the bird. "There won't be anyone here to rescue you." Because there was a wind from the north, and their aunt's condition was precarious, Franny took the sparrow down to the stairwell landing so she could pry open the green glass above the window seat. She watched as the bird lifted into the air. When she turned, she was stunned. Her aunt was beside her. "How did you get here? Let me help you back to bed," Franny said.
"I want to give you this."
There, on the velvet seat cushion, was Maria Owens's sapphire. Franny had read about it in Maria's journal, the jewel her lover had given to her.
"Wear it, and your heart will come back to you.
Do it now." Because her aunt was so insistent, Franny slipped on the necklace, tucking it under her blouse. It was surprisingly warm. Jet came to the top of the stairs and called to Franny.
"Hurry! She's failing!"
"No, she's right here!" But when Franny looked, there was no one beside her. She ran upstairs where her aunt signaled for her to come near. Franny went to her bedside and knelt down beside her.
"Oh, dear aunt," Franny said, "I have so many more things I want to discuss with you. You can't go now?"
"I don't make all the decisions, you know," Isabel managed to say. "I just do the best I can to face what life brings. That's the secret, you know. That's the way you change your fate."
Vincent had edged closer to the door. His face was ashen. It was an awful sight to see such a strong woman become so weak, like a moth folding up on itself.
"I don't know if I can stay," he murmured.
"You'll stay," Franny told him. "We owe her that and more."
"You don't owe me anything," Isabel managed to say.
Franny patted her arm.
"Don't exert yourself," she urged their aunt.
Isabel had very little energy. She gestured for Franny to lean in as she spoke her last words. No one heard but Franny, for the message was a final gift, and one that brought Franny to tears. When Isabel sighed, the last of her breath rose to the ceiling, then followed the path of the sparrow into the hallway, down the stairs, out the window. By then the house was dark. Somehow night had fallen. It was after midnight, the 10th day. Time had passed so quickly they hadn't even noticed. The sisters washed their aunt with warm water and black soap, then dressed her in white. They went down to the garden, where the night was starry and clear. Later, Charlie came with his sons to carry their aunt down from her room in the coffin. She was taken in their van to the old cemetery where the children's parents had been buried. They knew she didn't want any fanfare, therefore no service was held. They sent a telegram to April in California, and to the Owenses in Maine, and to the ones in Boston, with the date and time of Isabel Owens's death. Contributions in her name could be made to the town library. Charlie's two sons, who had been cured of drug addiction and thievery by Isabel Owens, and who'd always been afraid to look her in the eye, wept as they lowered the coffin. Jet had phoned April when they'd learned Isabel had taken ill, and April had sent a huge flower arrangement of white roses and ferns. Jet gave the blessing from the book of poems she had given her aunt.
"In this short life that only lasts an hour, how much, how little, is within our power."
"She was a good woman," Charlie said.
Vincent insisted on refilling the grave himself. He stripped off his black jacket and his boots and socks, then labored, digging, until he was sweating through his white shirt. He'd brought along a bottle of whiskey, and they all toasted to the memory of Isabel Owens. When Franny told her brother and sister they had inherited the house, all three knew they needed to return to Manhattan. As they were bound not to sell the property, they would let it stand empty. Franny hired Charlie to be the caretaker, to make certain that no one vandalized the house in the absence of any tenants, and ensure that vines or roots which might disturb the plumbing or the foundation be cleared away. When they returned to the house, Franny gave Charlie the chickens and said they might be reclaimed some day, but until then he was entitled to all the eggs they would lay. When the Merrills had gone, Jet came to stand beside her sister. They looked out at the garden, which had now turned to straw. Isabel had done all of the autumn planting, but she wouldn't see anything bloom in the spring.
"What did she say to you at the end?" Jet asked.
She'd been wondering ever since their aunt had whispered something that had brought Franny to tears.
"She said you and I should share the grimoire. She said the sight would come back to you."
A blister arose on Franny's tongue as she spoke. Ever since she and Jet had shared a room, they had shared all that they had, but the one thing Franny wanted to keep for herself was her aunt's last words. Jet took her sister's hand.
"You were her favorite."
It was true. Early that morning, Franny had found a card Isabel had left under her pillow.
"If there be a cure, seek till you find it. If there be none, never mind it."
Today everything smelled earthy, the rich scent of mulch and decaying leaves and roots. It was an ending and a beginning, for the month itself was like a gate. October began as a golden hour and ended with Samhain, the day when the worlds of the living and the dead opened to each other. There was no choice but to walk through the gate of time. Franny had already packed up her suitcase and carried the grimoire with her. The book and all it contained was now theirs. While they waited for Vincent to shower and change, the sisters took a final inventory of the house. They found the keys to the front door in the silverware drawer, and Isabel's bank book in the vegetable bin. They packed up the remedies stowed in the cabinets into several boxes that would fit neatly in the trunk of the rented car. The sisters sat in the shade of the arbor beside the shed. Wisteria grew here in spring and spread out like a canopy, grapes twisted along the structure in late summer. The town was sleepy, but without Aunt Isabel's presence it was empty as far as Franny and Jet were concerned. They were tempted to uncover the black mirror in the greenhouse and take one last peek at the future, but they restrained themselves. Instead, they crammed the car with belongings, locked the front door, and cut down an armful of bare lilac branches to take with them before latching the gate. What the future would be was yet to be discovered. As for the past, they already knew it too well. Part 5. Gravity. It came on the wind, the way wicked things must, for they are most often weighted down with spite and haven't the strength to lift themselves. On the first day of December, 1969, the lottery was held. Men between the ages of 18 and 26 would be drafted to fight in Vietnam, according to their birth dates. Lives were interrupted, and fortunes were exchanged. A cold drizzle hung down, and flurries of snow fell in swirls. There were no stones thrown or drownings, no pillories or burnings. Those chosen were computerized, their fates picked at random. Life went on despite the lottery. Traffic headed down Broadway. Men and women showed up for work. Children went to play. The world breathed and sighed, and people fell in love and got married and fell out of love and never spoke to one another again. Still, the numbers drawn had the weight of ruin and sorrow. They turned young men old in an instant. A breath in, and a man was chosen to walk on a path he'd never expected to take. A breath out, and he must make the decision of a lifetime. Some would leave the country, some went to jail. Some were ready to take up arms and die for the country they loved, despite the heartbreak of leaving families and friends. All were torn apart. It was said that fate could not be altered, except by one thing, and that was war. Because Vincent was born on the 14th of September, his was the first number drawn, the 258th day of the year. He was in a bar on the Lower East Side when it happened, a no-name place for lost men where the drinks were